This is a Vision Australia radio podcast.
Welcome to Cover from Vision Australia Radio. I'm Tim McQueen. Cover to Cover is recorded on the lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the first Australians and traditional owners of the land across our broadcast areas. I pay my respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. In this edition, lots of Australian writing. From Elwood Writers, Portrait by Barry Lee Thompson, The Pocket Handkerchief on the Edge of the World by Margaret McCaffrey, Behind the Mask by Helen MacDonald, and Grey by Barry Lee Thompson with a new introduction, as well as The Writer by Barry Lee Thompson and On the Road by Julie Coe. Elwood Writers recently participated in the 20 Artists Project supported by the City of Port Phillip Cultural Development Fund. 20 artists, 20 literary pieces by 20 Port Phillip artists. Behind the Mask by Helen MacDonald. From 20 artists, 20 literary pieces by 20 Port Phillip artists, and written issue number 1. Cautious we approach, forgetting the smallness of talk. We hold back shyly, sensing the loss. Normal is an illusion, conceals cracks in the veneer. We stumble to connection. Suicide, the widening gap. Evading another, so ingrained, how do I know myself when the mirror that is you has gone dark? Can I gauge who I am, adrift, dancing alone? Muted, unable to share, the hollow, the disconnect. Playgrounds empty of children, theatres gone dark, false personas in a virtual world. I fall back, pull on the glazed mask. Let the act begin. Behind the Mask, Helen MacDonald. Portrait by Barry Lee Thompson, read by Barry.
The scratching of the pencil as it moves across the paper. Have you sat for a portrait before, he said. His name was Everlet. He advertised for subjects so he could practice faces. I'd already asked if he'd prefer me looking down or up, eyes open or closed. Just be yourself, he'd said. Read, if you like. I said I'd use the time to sit quietly. I found his face interesting, its concentration, a slight frown, as he worked out where and how to place marks on the paper. He caught me looking and said I had a naturally smiling expression. That's when he asked if this was my first time. No, I said, once before when I was very young, on holiday. It was 1974. I didn't tell Everlet the year, too revealing, and the year doesn't matter for the story, although it does to me. The place, like the year, is unimportant, though if he'd asked for either, I'd have told him. I was 6 years old and wanted to have my portrait done by an artist near the beach. On the esplanade, easel set up in the sun, she worked in pastels. The artist signed the picture when she'd finished. Her first name began with an A, and the whole was hard to decipher. I rubbed a patch of colour, and a dusting came off the paper and onto my fingertip. I was delighted with the picture. We went to drop it off at the guest house so it wouldn't get damaged. Go and show it off, said my parents. It was the middle of the afternoon and quiet in the guest house. I ran down to the kitchen. Look, I said to our waiter and the chef and the manager, Mr. Braxton, who had a soft spot for me. I just had it done. They all rushed to look, and something came over their faces. You could have smiled, one of them said. I could tell they were all thinking it, even Mr. Braxton with his soft spot, his way of pulling out my chair at breakfast and dinner. I paused. Go on, said Everlet, not lifting his eyes from his work. My parents put the portrait away after the holidays, and now it's somewhere safe, but I don't know where. So since then, what happened? Said Everlet. Maybe I've laughed a lot since then, I said. What you see now is remnants, echoes of laughter. Maybe it's all surface. The scratching of the pencil. I think I'm done, he said. Already, I said. I worked quickly. He turned the picture round. The face was unsmiling. Do you think it looks like you? Photographs, do they look like us? Does anything? Have you ever glanced in a mirror and thought, oh my God, who is that? I considered the portrait that night when I was alone at home. Its unfamiliarity unsettled me, so I put it away, somewhere safe.
Margaret McCaffrey.
A pocket handkerchief at the edge of the world. In some ways, my life began when I was 4 in St Kilda. The cows on my father's dairy farm were patient creatures with doleful, loving eyes, but they couldn't talk or wave at me. On the weekends that my parents came to town, Dad might drop me off at my grandmother's place. The landing to Nana's flat was near pitch black. As I grew older, I became aware of there being two doors. One was hers, the other belonged to a mysterious tenant whom I never spotted. To the right of Nana's door was a breadbox forged into the wall. On days when she forgot her keys and we were locked out, I used to wish that a younger brother of mine was accompanying me so he could squirm his little slippery jelly body through the L-shaped chute and into her kitchen. Once inside the flat, we'd adjust our eyes to the light. Her kitchen featured a kookaburra gas stove, a wire mesh meat safe to keep things cool, and a toaster whose sides flopped open at will. Nana said you could tell it was breakfast time by the smell of burnt toast. I was quick to get to the red chenille-covered rectangular table that stood in the alcove of her living room and overlooked Fitzroy Street. I ignored the sideboard to the left in the darkened part of the room where she kept a squat bottle of Karai five-star whiskey. On a tough day when she might have forgotten her keys, or perhaps we'd all become too much for her, she'd dive into the back of the cupboard and take a swig from the bottle with a, "Don't tell your father." I was never sure why I wasn't to tell him. She rarely did it, and I was fairly certain I'd seen Dad having a beer at the Pakenham pub on our drive home to Warragul. To the right of her living room was the bedroom where she kept a statue of the Sacred Heart on a dresser between her bed and mine. At night she burned a red votive candle before which at night she knelt in whispered prayer. The story went that every morning she attended Mass in the city to pray her 3 sons home from the Second World War. I adored my grandmother, and for me, she could do whatever she liked. She'd had first-hand experience of how life could be precarious for endangered men. Through the wide steel-framed windows of her living room, she and I would watch the men who lived in the triangular park across the road. It was a small patch of land bordered by several roads skirting the sea. Sometimes it felt to me that nothing except the island of Tasmania separated Nan and me and these men, the watchers and the watched, from the edge of the world. On Friday nights I huddled over a cardboard box of fish and chips to spy the police arriving in their divvy vans and round up the men who'd make the park's dusty floor and overhead foliage their home. You could almost hear the dry pods from the banyan tree crackling beneath their feet as they raised their bottles of brown-papered booty to the sky in a mixture of acceptance and defiance. Each Friday they were piled into the back of the paddy wagon as part of a weekly ritual and they were carried away. On Saturdays the street below us gave way to that of bodgies and widgies who took the stage, perhaps for the benefit of weekend tourists. They cruised the street in fluorescent socks of orange and blue, red and green. The bodgies nonchalantly combed their hair forward into the shape of a St Kilda wave, weaving and bobbing their bodies to a tune we couldn't hear. I didn't aspire to be a widgie girlfriend as a child, but dreamt of one day owning a luminous green sweater with a white stripe of rebellion woven into its V-necked collar. To me, the bodgies provided the technicolour expanse for a point-counterpoint, silent opera viewed by us from the vantage point of Nana's dining table. The drab of the squatter's confidence contrasted perfectly with the brash leer of the youthful future. I looked inquiringly at Nana, with her greying hair and long floral dress, to gauge what she made of it all. She'd look down at me. "As long as they're happy," she'd say with a kindly nod. By late Sunday afternoon, the patch of dry grass across the street from us came to life again as the men in their brown ragged coats and patched boots were returned by paddy wagon to their shelter in the park. Where had they been? The child in me hoped they'd been taken care of while away. I imagined them squashed into a noisy cell at the police station. But they seemed cheerful enough, waving to passers-by or an imaginary stage audience watching from the dress circle, while they proceeded to set up their newly purchased bottles in the preordained order and to resume unimpeded rustic domesticity for another 5 days. On those evenings, there was always the nagging suggestion in my half-formed mind that a complicity existed between police and the park squatters. I couldn't put my finger on it, not having the internal literacy for the unspoken agreement that might exist between the representatives of the powerful and those relegated to find their own kind of freedom. I will learn later that the word for an unacknowledged agreement between two opposing forces but reliant on each other is symbiosis. The men's return to the visible world was reassuring to a child of 5 or 6 who could see that the park's inhabitants were all right. The men were okay, and life as she observed it would keep on going in its endless, ever-widening, concentric circles.
A Pocket Handkerchief on the Edge of the World by Margaret McCaffrey, read by Margaret, from 20 Artists, 20 Literary Pieces by 24 Philip Artists, handwritten issue number 1, supported by the City of Port Phillip Cultural Development Fund. I first broadcast Grey by Barry Lee Thompson in October 2020.
Grey, the fifth story in Broken Rules and Other Stories, tells the tale of an empathetic sex worker and a new client, an elderly man whose financial circumstances preclude any further appointments. Once their session is over, instead of leaving, the worker accompanies the elderly man to the local park, where they spend time talking and enjoying coffee and ice cream. Here's a situation where time is money, but the younger man wants no additional payment and simply enjoys the company of the other, despite occasional flashes of crankiness. A while ago, I heard a sex worker being interviewed about their experiences. They were asked how they approached situations where they found the client unattractive, and the humanity of their response stayed with me. They said that they never think of anybody as unattractive, that every person has something about them that's attractive. In Grey, the older man anticipates a need to provide a something that the other will find attractive and fulfilling. And when they're in bed, he produces black and white images of himself in his younger days. The person in these photos is simply a different version of the man that presents them. All that separates the two iterations is the passage of time. Surely the current version must retain vestiges of earlier versions and something more substantial than memories or echoes. It's this consideration that sparked the story. I'd been wondering about the ways in which we are the sum of our earlier selves, how we carry our pasts or histories, and what remains or develops as we age. We cannot know for sure if the sex worker in Grey needed the stimulus of the photos. I'd like to think that the photos were unnecessary, that he's an astute observer, good at his job, discerning and intuitive enough to not require so obvious a clue. The evidence in the story certainly points to this conclusion. He is, after all, in the business of people and their qualities and intimacies. Empathy and understanding run both ways in Grey, and this may be one of the reasons why the two characters form a comfortable and easy bond. But what will happen when their time in the park inevitably comes to an end?
Grey by Barry Lee Thompson from his collection Broken Rules and Other Stories, published by Transit Lounge in 2020.
Afterwards, I dressed quickly, while he watched from the bed. Then I examined the framed photograph he'd placed on the nightstand earlier. To help me out, he'd said as he'd arranged them, black and white images of him from a more youthful time. In some, he was alone. In others, with friends, boyfriends, androgynous groups at the beach, in backyards. I picked up one of the pictures, a solitary figure, firm and brimming, on a seawall, a bare knee drawn up to his chin. Brilliantined hair, cut in a similar style to mine. You? I said, inclining the frame towards him. He nodded. Handsome, I said. Who took the picture? He shook his head, said he didn't remember, that it was probably a friend. He got out of bed and dressed with slow care into a light grey suit. The suit was much too big for him. It did him no favours and put years on him. It gave him the lonely look of one who's lost all sense of self-awareness and who no longer has reliable friends to provide kind advice against wearing grey suits. On closer inspection, and I felt this was okay to do, I noticed that the suit, like him, was frayed in parts and had tide marks of greasy grime at the inner cuffs and on the top of the collar. But it had possibly, based on the photographic evidence, been a good fit at one time. As I fingered the fabric, he watched patiently, and this felt more intimate than anything that had happened in the bed. I felt solicitude for the frame rattling inside the garment, and I didn't want to leave the old man just yet. He said he was going for a walk in the park, and I followed him, down in the elevator, then by his side, and he didn't seem to find this unusual. As we walked, he told me he was accustomed to taking coffee in the park every morning, unless the weather was wet or cold. We wandered among the early morning activity of shops and cafes preparing for the day ahead. A delivery driver was unloading boxes from the back of a van. He looked at the old man and smiled at me. When we passed the van, the old man said, "He thought you were my son." I peered sideways. His expression was serious. "Grandson, more like," I thought. "Sometimes," he said, "I come out for a walk, even if it's raining. As long as it's not too cold. I've never actually minded the rain." We stopped at the gates to the park. He told me we'd arrived. I had no bookings for the rest of that day, so I suggested I might come in and sit with him a while. He hesitated. "I can't pay you for this," he said under his breath, as if someone might be around to hear. "What's left has to last me for the rest of the week." I told him, no, it was okay, I just wanted to spend some time in the park. He led the way through the gates and across the unkempt grass to a stone and wooden bench beneath a spreading tree. It was a peaceful setting, mossy and secluded. No one else in the park, apart from us and the birds. I asked him about the tree, what type it was. He shook his head. He had no idea. I was surprised he didn't know. After a while, "About now," he said, "would normally be the time for my coffee." I told him I'd get coffee for both of us. "I wasn't suggesting," he said, making moves to find his wallet. I touched his hand, stopped his search, refused his money. I went to the cafe he'd indicated outside the park and across the road. He said they made good coffee in there. "In parts of Italy," he said, "they would struggle to make it so well." At the cafe, I joined a line of three customers. While I waited, I christened the old man Grey, with an A, an American way, on account of his hair and his suit. Spelled that way, the name seemed lighter, more informal, and was more like an actual nickname, short perhaps for Grady or Graham or Grayson. Not that he would ever know this name I'd given him. It was a mental shorthand I was accustomed to using for clients. I took the coffee back to the bench. Grey was as I'd left him, occupied with being seated, listening to the birds, watching the park. The coffee turned out as he'd described. The morning was getting warmer. I hadn't had any breakfast. I asked Grey if he was hungry. He said he rarely ate breakfast. He rarely ate anything. I said I'd be back soon, and I went to a kiosk I'd noticed earlier and bought two ice cream cones. They started to melt as I carried them back to the bench, and they went all over my fingers. He gave me his handkerchief to clean up the mess. He said this was the first ice cream he'd had in a long time. I asked him how long. He said he didn't know exactly. He asked if it was important. I shook my head. I stared through the canopy of green above us. A police or ambulance siren erupted. I listened to its wail fade away, then tried to pick out traffic noises from between the calls of birds. "Living alone," he said. Then nothing. I cleared my throat. "Living alone," he continued, "is, well, it makes a person forget things. How to speak, and how to be with people." Conversation was like a muscle needing regular practice, he said, and he'd become rusty. "It's a long time since the last ice cream. I don't remember exactly. Long enough to make a remark." He stared off to the edge of the park. Railings separated this enclave from the rush of the road. Without the railings, without the road, we might have been in some wild, forgotten meadow. "It's a habit coming here," he said. "To the same place every time. Almost every time. Once or twice, someone's been on this bench, and I've had to find another place to sit. I was annoyed those times, irritated by the person who'd intruded." He smiled. "I wanted to pull him off the bench, or at least tell him to go somewhere else. Silly. But this is mine, I feel. It's only human to occasionally experience an urge towards something uncivilized," I said. "You knew this was the bench," he said, serious again. "When we came in. How did you know?" I told him I hadn't known. "But you brought us over here," he said. I told him he'd chosen the bench, and I'd followed. He nodded. "Ah, I must seem rude," he said. "You're polite, well turned out, you make an effort, and you bought ice cream and the coffee." He made a move to get his wallet again. I waved him away. "I have to pay you," he said. "I invited you. Let me pay for the coffee at least. It will make me feel better." I told him again to keep hold of his money. I reminded him that he hadn't invited me to the park, that I'd asked if I could join him. If anything, I was the rude one, the intruder. Anyway, if it bothered him, he could buy the coffees next time. That satisfied him, but only briefly. He said there probably wouldn't be a next time. "I can't afford to see you again," he said. "Not for a long time. And I don't have a long time. And you won't come all the way over here just for coffee." His eyes were full of searching, the lost eyes of a dog. I wondered if he might be asking a question. "It's not such a long way," I said. "And it'd be worth the journey for the coffee." There was a tone to this which I regretted. Meaningless, flippant, or worse, patronizing. I pressed on with the point, though. I tried to convince him that I would come over to see him one day. But I was much too insistent, and knew, even as I was assuring and denying his words and believing my own, that I would never see him again. Grey, by Barry Lee Thompson, from Broken Rules and Other Stories, published by Transit Lounge in 2020.
I often used to sit with him while he worked on a story. I could say that all the while he was writing, but often he'd only be reading over something he'd already written. He took ages over the smallest detail. I'd be in the armchair by the window reading a paperback novel I'd brought from school, and without moving my head, I'd look over to catch him engrossed in some part of the page he was on, and I'd stare and stare, waiting for him to turn that page over or to put it down or look away from it, but he wouldn't, not before I'd tired of watching and gone back to my book. Sometimes I'd hear him clear his throat as a preamble, an announcement, and I'd look up and then he'd read something aloud, a sentence or a phrase or small group of words. "How did that sound?" he'd ask. "It sounded fine," I'd say. Then he'd read the same words again and ask me how it sounded that time. "Fine," I'd say again, unsure of any difference in the readings. He'd nod and search my face as if looking for the thing I wasn't saying. Then he'd say, "Okay," and return to the page. I'd wait, thinking he'd be coming back to those words, but he never did. I came to realize that this was because he already had his answer. He might ask what I thought of this word or that word. "What does the word mean?" I'd ask. "It doesn't matter what it means," he'd reply. "What do you think of it?" And I learned to report the first thing I'd felt not thought, when I'd first heard the word a moment before. "It frightens me," I might say, or "it sounds hard," or I might tell him how it made me think of biscuits and hot tea. "Why? Why does it do those things? Why does it frighten you?" he'd ask. "Is it because you don't know the word? Does the uncertainty bother you?" And on we'd go like this, probing. All the while he was looking straight through my eyes into the bowels of my soul. I felt it as a discomfort, that nothing could be withheld or hidden, but I didn't understand it fully. Now I know he was acquiring details, taking pains over tiny crumbs that were often neglected. A wonder for me was not that he was never bored, because I think he was too absorbed to be bored, but the wonder for me then and now was that he ever got a complete story written from beginning to end. I didn't realize at the time that he was teaching me a way of writing, to experience words in a particular way, or showing me how to see life in a particular way. I don't think he realized he was doing this, or he wasn't doing it deliberately. Perhaps it was entirely selfish on his part, using me to test his stories. But I learned discipline, learned to take my time. His was a way of writing I've come to adopt for myself. I don't have anyone sitting in the armchair by the window, though. No one to bounce ideas off. The chair is there, empty, but sometimes I'll imagine my younger self sitting there as I must have sat back then. And I'll read out a word or a phrase or a passage, and for just a moment I'll hear the response, that the passage evokes a tea tray in a cozy, firelit room, or that a certain word is harsh, too harsh, or that it's troubling, or even that it touches something inside, something that is really quite frightening.
On the Road, from New Australian Fiction 2023. Julie Coe is the author of Capital Misfits and Portable Curiosities. The latter was shortlisted for several awards and led to Julie being named a 2017 Sydney Morning Herald Best Young Australian Novelist. Her short stories have been published widely in Australia and internationally. She has written radio plays for ABC Radio National and the libretto for the satirical opera Chop Chef. On the Road is dedicated to Paul Smith and Richard Lee. I first met Paul not long after my car and I split up. Technically, it had been my aunt's, but I loved it dearly and had lost it in a rendezvous with a speeding tree. I'd been wandering the streets without it when, one night, uptown, Paul came tumbling out of the entrance to some sort of gala. He was drunk and staggered towards me for a cigarette. I pulled one out of my case and lit it up for him. He took a drag. "God, I'm thirsty," he said, and licked his lips. Paul's father and grandfather had made money in grocery stores, hotels, and pharmaceuticals. When Paul turned 18, his father had sat him down and said, "Son, we worked so you don't have to." And so Paul had all this time in his hands, an endless stretch of it, and he spent that time scrounging around, trying to find something to do to keep the black dog at bay. At first, Paul tried to get an art history degree, but he was on coke half the time and hanging out at bars, slipping K into girls' drinks. His dad got him an internship at a leading auction house to encourage his art hobby, but it didn't stick. In the end, he dropped out of school. He started to take an interest in collecting historical documents, drawing up the family tree. It turned out there was a suspected Nazi on his mother's side, and somewhere on his father's, a connection with Lord Elgin, the 7th or 8th, I don't remember which. One day, at the family's weekend house in the Hamptons, Paul was telling his dad about how he was going to write a book about their family history. His dad's response was that Paul should forget about the whole thing. "This is not the time, Paul," his father had said, flicking through a contract at his desk. "Things aren't good right now, and you know how I feel about historians. They all want to get famous proving you're complicit in some sort of evil regime when you're just a savvy player in a system." They got into a screaming match about it. Paul sobbed about having the one hobby that gave his life meaning taken away from him. "What about our bunker in Australia?" his dad said. "You begged for it and I gave it to you. Wasn't that supposed to be a hobby too?" "Fuck the bunker!" Paul picked up a hot poker from the fireplace and charged right at his dad, who dodged it. Then Paul went to his room and gathered all his historical research papers, ran out onto the tennis court, and made a bonfire with them. He stood next to the tiny mound as it burned, staring up the white sash windows of his father's study with eyes full of thwarted love. His father, expressionless, stared back at him for a few seconds before turning to leave for a meeting with his legal team. Paul was so angry and so bored, he wanted to be dead. But at the same time, he wanted to live. Which is why he turned up that same day at my aunt's shithole in New Jersey, in a blue French work jacket, and said, "Jules, my guy, it's time to get away from it all and meet the open road." What could I do? I was tired of living with my aunt, trying to butter her up for cash, and Paul had this way about him, a glint in his eye. He'd left the bonfire as it was, shriveling into black, and stole his old man's red jalopy, a piece of sentimental junk, ripping off down the road just as the chauffeur was patting his pockets for the key. It didn't take long for me to pack a bag. I was going to be the most revered writer of the counterculture. I was going to write books that burned like the sun. And my first book was going to be about Paul and the story of this road trip, and I was going to share it with the world via that agent I met once at that party who said I had just the right face to sell books. I got in the jalopy and Paul started it up. The car rattled, but soon we were flying. Paul was humming Macklemore, the one about the thrift shop, and the sun was setting, and it was goddamn glorious. Keeping one hand on the wheel, he reached into the glove compartment and pulled out a bunch of orange prescription bottles. We swallowed some uppers. Paul gunned the jalopy up to 60, then sped to 80, then to 120. Dusk fell around us, deepening into the colour of eggplant, as the jalopy hugged the curves of the cornfields, following that hard, true line that unrolled eternally by our side. It was a straight, winding, lovely, ugly, holy, cursed road, which would soon give its secrets up to us. I felt pure and clean and reborn. We picked up a homeless guy in Harrisburg and a hipster in D.C., then stopped in Pittsburgh, where we ate bread and cheese and donuts and downed more uppers. We lost the homeless guy in a diner. Then the hipster and I traded seats, and we pushed on past creaky little towns and big brash cities with their sparkling lights, through Denver, L.A., Tucson, Chicago, SF and New Orleans, then up to Cincinnati, taking the I-75 to Toledo, then Detroit. In Detroit, the hipster ran out to take a piss on a wall somewhere. We didn't wait, and left for Houston, where we met a businessman who wanted to go with us to Des Moines. After dropping the guy off, we roared through New York, Salt Lake City, L.A., Denver, New Orleans, SF, D.C., Denver, D.C., Chicago, New Orleans, L.A., Denver, Chicago, Denver, New York, Denver, and Denver, sleeping along the way in pokey, dank little hotels that Paul's dad owned, where the valets regularly took more than 3 minutes to retrieve our car. Outside Cheyenne, sirens came for us. Paul tried telling the cop a sob story about his dad branding him with a poker, but he got a speeding ticket anyway.
The cop moseyed off, and I slid into the driver's seat. We had some pinks from one of Paul's bottles, pills shaped like eyes. Then we were on our way again, on our long drive to nowhere. Paul started telling me a story about the time he took a solo trip after a fight with his dad. He picked up 2 16-year-old girls in Iowa and drove naked with them on his lap, and they all smoked cigarettes while Paul expounded on Proust and Nietzsche and the Stoics, until one of the girls threw up the dozen bad oysters he'd fed her, and she looked up at him with big, sad eyes. And in that moment, he sort of fell in love with that skinny little kitten with puke dripping off her chin. And then Paul started talking to me about the eyes being windows to the soul, that Modigliani knew this, that Modigliani was the greatest artist of all time, that Paul had seen on TikTok that Modigliani insisted on painting blank eyes because you need to know the soul to paint the eyes, and the only non-blank ones that he ever painted were in pictures of his wife. Paul went on, Modigliani this, Modigliani that, and I was like, yeah, Paul, maybe we should go see some of Modigliani's in some goddamn museum. And Paul said, no need, I just bought one. Well, I didn't strictly buy it. Dad set up a trust fund for me in the Virgin Islands, and the trust bought the Modigliani. It's an epic way to hide your wealth offshore, untouched by the tax man. Paul said he was also really into Khmer relics, like those heads of gods that people lop off at temples. He was also fond of anything that came out of Nepal and India and some of the vases and shit from China and that old summer palace. He'd had a taste of buying this sort of art during the internship his dad had got for him at that auction house before he was sidetracked by the family history stuff. His dad was a bit of a connoisseur of Asian art and collected it, so Paul was going to follow in his footsteps. But offshore trusts were getting too much media attention lately, especially since his dad's main art dealer got fucked in that big leak, stuff about how he used former child soldiers to loot Cambodian temples. So, things were dicey. Paul had decided his own life calling was to be a neo-minimalist. Just art and pussy and floorboards. That's all a guy needs in life. He was maybe waiting to get into 3D printing with his family's Asian relics, make some NFTs, evolve into a philanthropist. I went to Thailand a while back, you know, Paul said. He'd followed his poet pal, Richard L. Wayne, the fast fashion heir, over there because Richie had a gig at the time performing his poetry about Asians being the metaphorical children of the world to expats and probable expat pedos in an expat literary cafe in Bangkok. That's where Paul met up with his dad's art dealer, a crusty old British guy, and they all flew together to Angkor Wat and stood among the ancient tree roots growing down over the temple buildings. Paul went and touched one of those roots and felt the awesome depths of that culture rush into his veins, and that's when he realised he was going to make a real difference in the world. He told Richie about his epiphany, but Richie said, "You can't change the world, man. Your family is the world." And Paul said, "Fuck you, man," and threw his best of Gandhi into the dirt and ran back to their resort and lay by the pool and cried. So, Paul wanted to know, did I want to come and see the bunker his dad had given him out in Tasmania? Because that's where he thought his next project would be. "I'm going to be a custodian of Asian culture," he said. I didn't really know what he meant, but I said, "So, fire," and we started making plans to go. As we drove through Sacramento, Paul asked if I was going to invest in some art too, with all that money my family had made through tear gas and drones and private armies. If so, he could give me the details of the law firm that drew up his trust. "Well, Paolo," I said, "fine art isn't really my bag, and I don't have liquidity right now, but maybe I'll do a defence contract on the side so I can pursue my dream of being one of the greatest writers of all time. The sort of guy that makes people want to reach out and grab life by the throat and really fucking murder it, you know? Slit that throat and drain every last drop of blood, tie the corpse to iron weights and drop it in the ocean so no one ever finds it." At the end of the day, as the fat moon rose and squatted above the clouds, we rolled back into Sacramento and heard a tenor sax wailing out of a bar, infusing the city with an intricate Bo Burnham cover. We pulled up near the bar and went in. Some locals shouted us a few rounds of beer. I had my eye on a darling little exotic black-haired wench of about 17 who was standing out the front of the bar. I went out and followed her up the road. I tailed off her streets and streets, finally getting a hold of her at a crosswalk, but she wiggled out of my grasp and ran away. By the time I returned to the jalopy, Paul was sitting in the back seat, entwined with another girl he'd lured with his flaming charisma. They were naked, his jeans around his ankles. She looked like a baby and had had a lot to drink. "Get in," Paul said. "I was just telling the young lady about my travel philosophy." I got in the front and slammed the door shut. "The thing is," he said to the girl, "I'm not just a tourist, I'm a traveller. I see the people. Like, don't take me to the tourist traps, take me to an underground bar where I can chug spice bomb mojitos, get my photo on the wall for chugging the most spice bomb mojitos, really get fucked up on spice bomb mojitos, you know, babe? I'm here to experience the world." By the time his mother called, the girl was straddling him. He put his mother on speaker. One of his hands was tweaking the girl's nipple and the other was sliding up and down his wang. "Where are you? Why haven't you been picking up?" his mother was shouting. "The lawsuits are coming in. There's bad press and in the middle of it, you have vanished. They've taken our name off that university in Georgia and that art gallery your dad loves so much. He's going to sue them both for breach of contract. To top it off, I got snubbed from the foundation luncheon." "Yes, mother," Paul was murmuring. "You're right, mother." But I could see in the rearview mirror that he was not really hearing any of it. He was breathing hard and had gone glassy-eyed, thirsting for that magnificent tit. "Are you listening to me, Paul?" his mother said. "Ours is a legitimate drug for people in real pain." "Oh," they moan, "my son died after these drugs were prescribed for a wrist injury." "If addicts want to destroy their lives, that's their problem. And what about my child? Who's thinking of my child? Whose good name is being destroyed? We've only ever helped people and look how they persecute us." Paul hung up as she was still talking. He lifted the girl off him and then pushed her head down into his crotch so she could finish him off, telling her that he wanted her to choke on his big fat cock. As they went at it, I vaped and watched a drunk pass out in the gutter across the road, and I wondered if the girl would let me hit it later when Paul passed out. In the end, he couldn't stay hard and the girl gave up, and he said it was probably the side effects of some of the pills he'd been popping. "You're lucky," he said to the girl. "You really would have choked if I wasn't on drugs." He checked his smartwatch and texted a guy back about the head of a Buddha he was interested in. Then he snorted something off the girl's thigh and finished up with blues from one of his orange bottles. "Hey, man," I said, "I don't know if you should be getting into those. Your mum would have a fit." "Not your business," he said. I watched him in the rearview mirror for some time. He began to yawn and his breathing seemed to slow. He nodded off. The girl was becoming drowsy too. I got out of the car and did 30 push-ups on the sidewalk to make my chest look good. Then I went around to her side and knocked on the glass. She opened her peepers a little to look at me, made a face, then closed them. So I dropped my jeans and started jacking off right there looking at her through the window. Paul was still knocked out, so I went for a walk and found a 24-hour waffle joint. I had a classic breakfast and started talking to the waitress at the counter about an idea I just had for a feminist story that I could write. "Okay," she said. I explained it to her. It was about a girl who's looking through a window. "And?" she said. I told her I hadn't decided what was going to happen next. It was complicated. What kind of window would it be? Would the frame be aluminium or wood? Was she outside looking in or inside looking out? The chick at the counter said, "Well, why don't you get into the mind of the girl? Figure out how she's feeling, what her circumstances are." "But great writing," I said, "is about the outer things that point to the inner. Staring through a piece of glass, now that's full of meaning. That's how you write classic literature that stands the test of time." And she said, "But don't you need to know what the inner is so you can point to it? I mean, what's going inside my head right now? Do you have any clue at all?" Well, I did, but I wasn't going to say it. She wanted me bad, but that wasn't going to happen. I wasn't going to lay pipe in a waitress who didn't know how to comprehend great literature. "Dude," she said, "maybe you should try writing with AI. She handed me my check. "Might give you some ideas." "It should be $15.99, I said, not $16.99. Back in the jalopy, Paul was still passed out, but the girl was gone. I jerked off again in the driver's seat at the thought of tweaking the politically correct tits of that waitress from the waffle joint and pushing her politically correct head into my crotch, teaching her a lesson about being such a dirty little tease like a dirty little mother brought her up to be. I squirted all over the steering wheel and fell asleep. At sunrise, Paul woke me up. The girl had come back, and the three of us made our way towards Fresno. We stopped at a charging station and plugged the jalopy in. Then Paul and I went for a movie and chow mein nearby. We bought Frappuccinos and headed back to the car, only to see the girl gunning the jalopy down the avenue, her arm raised high out of the window, middle finger up. We saw another movie. Paul seethed in his reclining chair, gripping the armrests. He'd wanted to call the cops, but I had to remind him we didn't know how young the girl actually was. During the closing credits, Paul told me we were down to our last 700 grand. Things were dire. In the foyer, I called my aunt and told her to send money. She started telling me off, saying that my parents would be turning in their graves at my behaviour and that I should get away from that good-for-nothing Paul. I knew in my heart that he was trouble, but what could be done? I had a book to write and 200 pages to fill. As I listened to my aunt, who was now in the middle of a full-blown rant, I watched Paul shove handfuls of popcorn into his mouth while looking for something else to get from the snack bar. It was then that I really saw him. He was wild and troubled, and I was the same, victims of a sad society. And yet we roared on, trying to find our authentic selves among the mess, wild to live, wild to exist, digging the whole world, a wild, wild world, full of wildest wildness. Paul, fingers now jammed into a pack of gummies, started talking about the bunker again. His granddad had bought it cheap in the 70s. It had been built by a paranoid American who'd died young of a heart attack. The bunker went 9 floors down. "There's a spiral ramp through the whole thing, like the Guggenheim," Paul said. He was planning to gut the decor and make it a museum of Asian art for the end times. "No one wants to know us now, so we need a gallery to display our art. It'll be a massive legacy for the family, a full-on rebrand." "Paolo," I said, "you're a goddamn genius." We hitched a ride to Van Nuys in an Uber and chartered a jet leaving in 5 days for Hobart, then Launceston, with a stop in Honolulu. Soon enough, we're in sunny Tasmania, driving among fields of white poppies, which were tinged blue. "Specially engineered variety," Paul said. "We make them into blues, paid all these farmers to grow them, offered them luxury cars and shit too." We went off-road and eventually stopped next to a barbed wire fence. A guy in fatigues appeared out of nowhere and let us in. "We'll be here for a while," Paul told him. "See you in the morning." A big steel door led into the side of a hill. The guy let us through and the door slammed shut. It felt like a tomb with a floor plan, like an old-school keyhole. Every floor had a round bit and a rectangular bit that jutted off it. The round bits together formed a cylinder. Paul led me down the spiral ramp he'd been telling me about, which curved around the outer part of the cylinder, all the way to the bottom. From where we were, I could see a pool on the ground floor. It was surrounded by stone relics and was part of a fake beach scene. "We'll go for a swim later," Paul said. The first thing he showed me was a grocery store full of cans of food. Then we kept going down through the spiral to all the different levels, and I saw that the place was packed with art. Random pieces, coated in dust, were lying around everywhere. Frames were stacked all over the desk in the medical clinic and on the faded pink tables in the restaurant. Stone gods were lined up in front of the screen in the cinema. In the hair salon, a golden Buddha reclined on a chair. In the chapel was a statue in a glass box of Jesus on the cross, though this, Paul said, was clearly for worship, not exhibition. It was like the family was using the place as a storage facility. There wasn't going to be anywhere to sit in the end times. We came to a shooting gallery. Paul took a gun off the wall and aimed at the jade goddess sitting next to one of the targets. He fired 5 shots and missed. Next stop was the residential floor. It was a scene out of the 70s, made up of a pale brick bungalow with a front yard made of fake grass. We went up the path to the front door, passing fake palm tree trunks that disappeared into the ceiling. The walls around the whole scene were painted with hills, blue skies, and clouds. In the living room, more frames and old Chinese vases were crammed on the coffee table. More relics sat above the TV and at the foot of the four-poster in the master bedroom. Next to the bed, Paul had put up a framed photograph of James Dean in a long coat walking through bad weather in Times Square. Back in the living room, I touched one of the relics, a huge stone head. Paul said it was really good karma to give that sort of thing a permanent place to live. They say the spirits are still in there. One day, for a fee, I could even take Asian apocalypse survivors through this room to connect with their culture. Then Paul started laughing because he had a foot fetish, but so many of his statues were cut off at the ankles. I had a vision of all the shit those footless spirits would watch when the annihilation of the world came to pass and Paul really settled into the bunker. All the naked K-infused honeys crawling across the carpet, bruising their thighs on fine art. "Beach time," said Paul. He opened a cupboard stuffed with historical outfits that looked like they belonged in a museum, armour and dresses and so on. He rummaged through and found some towels. We went down to the fake beach. The water was a bright aqua. We sat on our towels on the sand and took a couple of reds and some purples from Paul's bottles. He held up his last bottle of blues and shook it so it rattled. "Made by the best," he said. We emptied it. I had a bit and he had the rest. We lay back. It felt good. He pulled a remote control out of his pockets and the building went dark. On the ceiling of the building at the top of the spiral, stars appeared, spattered across the darkness. Then everything turned shades of blue, purple, pink, yellow and green. "Aurora Australis," said Paul, "an installation from an artist out of Boston. Helps me sleep when I'm here." We lay there for a while. I watched the colours swirl around us and realised how small we were in this gigantic universe. I began to think about our road trip, how much we'd grown to love each other as men, and how we would cherish the moment for the rest of our lives. Then Paul said, "You can also project porn on this thing." And into the coloured sky came tiny images of genitals and nipples and fingers and parted lips, arranged like a picture in a kaleidoscope, touching and separating and touching and separating. Paul turned to me in the dim light cast by the genitalia and said, "Jules, you know what I really want out of life? I want to feel deep, deep love. I want to be deeply, wildly in love with a girl." He started to scratch his arms, then reached out and took my face in his clammy hands, gurgling weirdly as he talked. "You and me, though, in my museum, transcendental." Tears streamed down his face. He was flushed. "We're on the edge of a new world, ma'am. We're on the edge of a new world." He wiped his cheek with the backs of his hands and began to nod off. I thought he was going to sleep, but then he got up suddenly and sprinted away. "Paul?" Macklemore began echoing through the bunker, and Paul tottered back in an ancient-looking costume that looked like it was made of straw and cloth. "Shamans, get up," he shouted over the music. "Can't remember where from." He tried to pull me onto my feet. Vibe, dude. But my eyes were now kaleidoscopes. I blinked twice, but still couldn't see right. Paul had 10 swirling faces and 100 angry eyes and 1,000 tongues and 1,000,000 arms. And my entire body felt like it was in slow motion, weighed down by an invisible force. All I could do was watch the shaman dance, split into swirling fragments in my mind. He was spinning and lurching and staggering, chanting nonsense in a voice I couldn't recognize. The scream of a wild animal came out of him. He began to convulse. Puke launched from those 1,000 tongues. He stumbled into that aqua water, went under. "Hello?" I tried to say, "Hello?" He was floating face down. I waded in, but felt like I was going to black out. I fumbled in my pocket for my phone to call someone, anyone, but I dropped the thing and the water swallowed it up. I dragged him out. He was tinged blue and limp. I wanted to breathe air into his lungs, but which of the 10 mouths was the right one? I tried to pick him up, get him on my back, but fell over. I thought about running up to find the guy in the fatigues. But I couldn't leave Paul alone. I just wanted to hold his hand. So I kept dragging him, dragging that heavy body up that endless spiral, up from the centre of the earth, and the tears and snot dripped off my chin, and I got him as far as the chapel before I knew I couldn't go on. I hauled him down the aisle. The carpet was red with yellow dots, and the pattern swirled in front of me. I left him dumped against the side of the pew, his head upright and his limbs sprawled. On my hands and knees I turned to face the altar, raised my hands to pray. They were still wet. Fluff from the carpet was stuck to my palms. In that silence, I begged for Paul to live. I promised that if he made it out, I'd do more meaningful things with my life than writing, like start that groundbreaking potty on venture capital. Just as I was about to pass out, I raised my eyes to Jesus, who stared down at me through the glass. I searched those big, sad eyes, and all I heard him say was, "My child, I thirst for you." On the Road by Julie Coe from New Australian Fictions 2023, published by Kill Your Darlings. And that's all in this edition of Cover to Cover. My thanks to Barry Lee Thompson, Margaret McCaffrey for their readings in today's edition. Join me again next week when Barry Leveny reads Heart Attacks by Brian T. O'Sullivan and Amstrander von Tangier by James Salter. In the meantime, keep listening to your local RPH network station for informative and interesting programs. And you can get podcasts of Cover to Cover from varadio.org, Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Tim McQueen. Until next time, goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this Vision Australia Radio podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform. Visit varadio.org for more.
Vision Australia Radio.
Blindness. Low vision.
Opportunity.